Blog Talk Radio.
TNT Tanya Talks on the Marty Oakley's TS Radio Network. Thank you once again for tuning in. It's Sunday evening, September 30th, 2018, and we've got a great show for you tonight. I use that word great in a manner that can certainly go both ways, because the stories that we bring on here are not so great, but that's why we're here, is to let you guys know about these stories for all of our advocates and whistleblowers and concerned citizens and people that are dedicated to making a difference out here. They get to hear these stories, and we all come together and we become a stronger voice, offer opinions, thoughts, provide connections. And we continue following each other as often as we possibly can. Well, tonight, James Treat from Calvin, Oklahoma, is not on. And that's because we also need to continue with bringing other victims onto the show. And there's a lot of work that's being done in Calvin, Oklahoma right now. Mark my words. And the updates will be provided, and there's some things we just are not able to share given the integrity of the investigations and the matters at hand, but this is not the last that you have heard or will hear about this, and things are in a forward-moving motion, and that's good. That's what we want, okay? And so I also would like to thank Stephen Burke from KRB FM Christian Radio. You can tune in 89.9 if you're in the Stuart, Oklahoma area, and you can listen that way. As well, you can always listen to the archive, which is available right on ppjg.me, or just link yourself once again to the promo link, what you're listening to right now, or you can share that to anybody that you know will be interested in listening as well. We want to thank Randall Stone for sharing the valuable radio shows and that are coming from Marty Oakley's network, as well as other networks on his station, which is Today's Voice radio show. Today's Voice, 24/7. He is replaying valuable podcasts. So I'm not an attorney. I'm an advocate, whistleblower, myself, or any affiliates, Marty Oakley, Randall Stone, Stephen Burke, are not liable for any content that is brought up here. We are simply sharing voices, stories with well-vetted guests that we've actually, in this case, and as well as any other case that I believe I've had on, not only, you know, built up understood the credibility of the guest, but I have seen proof and documents that lead me to bring this person on. And tonight we have David Arndt with us. Now, David is another victim of the court system in Oklahoma, but we know this happens not only in Oklahoma. It happens throughout our country. So these things sound familiar. We could be telling each other's stories, can't we, in this interesting political climate that we are in, regardless of what side you are on. And those that follow me and listen to this show know that I do non-biased shows. I do not take a position on my advocacy pages whatsoever, and that I believe that corruption has no party lines. So let's not just call out a party, let's call out the people. And I'll tell you what I'm calling out in Oklahoma. I'm calling out, and I plan to go to their enemies. I am calling out Senator Lankford. I'm calling out Attorney General Mike Hunter. I'm calling out those people, and I'm not even going to tell you what quote-unquote side they're on, but I'm going to go to the side that is against them politically, because if they're not going to dedicate themselves to doing their job, if they're just going to put out these little advertisements that sound like they're for you before the campaign time really settles in to make it sound like you matter, and yet you don't matter because they're not answering to you, because they're only answering to their political agenda, and that's getting voted back in again. To do what? To continue the collaboration of obstructing justice and being a part of the good old girls and boys club. So we're here to stop that. And people that come on here are putting themselves on the line and taking a risk. So thank you so much once again for being here. And please, we have provided certain links and will be providing information for links for proof to what David is about to share with us about his story. And this, again, is about, you know, a divorce gone wrong, about a divorce that went wrong, but there's stuff that happened before that. And you go to court thinking, okay, all right, Donna, we're going to get divorced. Whoever started this out, whoever started the action in the court, we're going to get divorced and we're going to go through it and then we're going to move on with our lives. And you think that's one of the hardest things that you're ever going to go through is just the divorce? Oh, my goodness gracious. Far too many of us know different. And that's what we're going to get into tonight. So without further ado, I do want to thank you, David Arndt, for showing up, being courageous. And anybody who has read any of the promo, they know a little bit about your history. But for those that have not had the opportunity to, can you start out with kind of like your bio of, you know, your personal and professional, just briefly, you know, life and what's led you here?
Sure. Thank you for having me, and thank you for helping me share. Just a little bit about me, as my bio had stated, I was kind of bullied all my life. We moved around 10 times in 11 years growing up, and we finally settled when I was in fifth grade. And because of that, I was not very social and was kind of behind the times. And so I was picked on a lot in school, and that carried on at home as well, as my dad was very verbally abusive with my mom and ridiculed her quite often in front of us. And he often turned that to us. I can remember times my dad calling me stupid and dumb, and yelling was a common factor in our home. And although not much physical, although there'd be occasional, usually it was more the emotional side of that, which, you know, to a kid is very devastating. And even to an adult, as I can testify now, that the emotional abuse doesn't just end when you're a child. It carries on with you when you're an adult. It has a lot of
and there are no scars, no external scars to show for it. People don't know. People just don't know what other people are going through sometimes, do they?
No, they really don't. So I one of my goals, dreams was to become a police officer. And I think really the thing that drove me the most to become a police officer was to be able to be that person that would rescue people out of bullied situations. And I took domestic violence very seriously as a police officer. I didn't tolerate it one bit. I didn't care who you were, what sex you were. I just didn't tolerate it. And I didn't tolerate bullies. I dealt with a lot of juveniles in a lot of cases where I was very firm with them, you know, as firm as you can be with a juvenile, I guess, in that respect. And so I did that for quite some time.
With the juveniles, especially to stop that pattern of behavior, to try to save them from themselves in a sense?
Correct. Yeah. To stop, really, it's about saving the individual, the juvenile, and others. But, you know, if you can reach that person that's doing the attacking and the bullying, then you've done a great deed, because that person, if that one person who bullies can affect so many people in so many levels.
Right. And you know, the bullies have their own personal deficiencies, but it doesn't justify the bullying. So trying to help that person become a better individual. And you also did that through your ministry practices. So let's show how that integration came into play.
Okay. So I had left law enforcement. I kind of was very disheartened at the system, seeing this revolving door in this cycle. And I had an opportunity to really listen to a lot of people tell stories in the back of my car about how, you know, nobody was giving them chances and stuff like that. And so my heart really wanted to be able to help people. And I thought, you know, law enforcement is not the best tactic to go after those people, you know, be firm with them, but let's give them options and choices. So I started a ministry, a restoration ministry, which took people out of jail, people that were on drugs, alcohol, bullies, you know, thieves, anything that, you know, any life struggle that someone had. And we had a restoration home. It was a year-long discipleship program where we gave them the word of God. We taught them how to work. We had a 14-acre garden. They'd go out and work and sell vegetables and other work around the community. And we just try and restore life back into them and teach them that they didn't have to live the way they once lived. And we had a lot of success, but, you know, as with anything, there's a lot of people that just don't want to change, and want to hold on to that old way. And so I did that for several years.
So can I ask you, though, because this is a huge debate that goes on regarding reform versus being put in jail, you know, juveniles or, you know, of age. How would you say that has worked? What would you say the percentage was? And I know we can't hold you to a number, but if you're thinking about it, just what percentage would you say if you had 100 people that you brought into this program, what's your best guess that you feel that people came out and stopped committing those crimes?
Well, I would say we were probably somewhere around the 40-50% range. But when you look
That's
at jail,
beautiful.
It has an even lower turnout. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
It really is. But like I said, you compare it to jail, that has a much lower rate of people that are turning around. You know, it's worth it, in my opinion, you know.
Right. Jail is a revolving door for so many. And if they're not being rehabilitated, of course, you know, each case, you know, and each crime has to matter, you know, the history and the severity of the crime and whatnot. But I think that is, you know, a tremendous success, mm-hmm. a tremendous success for just so many reasons. And you look at the taxpayers' money in these privately funded prisons, and, you know, and all, you know, how they're so crowded, and, you know, people are dying in them, and people are just getting to know other criminals that are not being able to be rehabilitated, or just that are just there for life. And, you know, it can really affect them and their outcome. And so here you are providing something, you found something that works really well in the big picture of statistics and reforming, you know, small-time criminals or mediocre or juveniles. And you've, you know, that's just phenomenal. Wow. That's excellent. Good for you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I mean, I remember one particular person, and I'll share this just to kind of really enlighten people on what people don't know about everybody that goes to jail. One particular person, 18 years old, he shared with me that he first did meth when he was 8 years old. And you know how he got introduced to meth was by his mom. His mom gave him a crack pipe of meth when he was 8 years old. So he admitted that he made the choices that he made. He was in and out of jail at a very young age, all the way up till he was 18, 19 when he was in our program. And he took responsibility for those, but he didn't know anything different. That's the way his mom taught him. That's how his mom raised him. And nobody gave him a chance because everybody wanted to label him as a meth addict because that's all the only lifestyle he knew. And that's
all.
I see that a lot more than we don't see in the jail system.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. And how did that work out then?
Well, he ended up leaving the program. At the point we were helping him, he ended up leaving the program. I think he got in trouble again, but I think he went to a different restoration program. And last I heard, he was doing okay.
Oh, excellent. So, excellent.
Yep.
Excellent. Okay, on to you. Keep going.
So, you know, I did the ministry for a while, and you know, one thing that I'd been praying to God about for a long time was a wife. I wanted a family, and I was getting old, or at least I think I was old in my 30s, and had never been married, and I'd been actively looking, and so God brought someone into my life that, you know, at the time said she was in love with God, and would follow me in ministry and seemed to give me the attention and the love that I thought I wanted. So we ended up getting married. It wasn't too long after we got married that she confessed that she didn't have a relationship with God and she really has issues with God, which was concerning to me. And so I tried to obviously address some of these issues and tried to help her and walk her through these. And slowly and slowly, I started seeing depression and mood swings. You know, I would call them bipolar mood swings. As you know, up one minute, you know, very happy and jovial, and then the next minute, just in the snap of a minute, angry and yelling at the top of her lungs, and for nothing, over little things. And this continued to get worse and worse.
How did you first respond when this behavior was something that you recognized, that you discovered was in her? How did you first respond? And when did it become futile?
Well, I first responded by, you know, just trying to listen and try and love on her as best I could. Tried to get her into counseling, and she quit on counseling. She a lot of times would say that I would make things up, or the counselor, you know, she didn't have to have disagreements with counselors. And then she got to a point where she refused to go to counseling at all. She wouldn't go at all. And so she kept wanting, we lived in Texas at the time, and she kept wanting to come back to Oklahoma. And I thought, well, you know, maybe if she comes home, this is family to her, maybe this will help her. And so, you know, I kind of left everything behind, I had left full-time law enforcement. I was still reserving, and I left the ministry. And several months prior to that, I was working another job to be able to provide for the family. But we moved to Oklahoma, and kind of things at first seemed like they were going a little bit better. But then it just, you know, more and more things began to spiral out of control. When we moved to Oklahoma, I was working two jobs for a while because we were just, you know, trying to survive. And I could never do anything that was good enough. I'd come home after working two jobs, and I'd still have to tend to the kids and cook or clean. And if I didn't do it because I was tired, I would get yelled at and called lazy. And I was working two jobs. I did everything I could to I guess you could call me the typical enabler, you know, in a relationship. I enabled her. I you know, she couldn't handle the kids. I'd tell her to go to her room and I would come home as exhausted as I was being. I would handle the kids, put them to bed, and clean and cook. And there was a point in time when I was still working two jobs, and she had texted me or called me and asked me for my Facebook password. And I thought it was an odd request, but I didn't really have anything to hide on my Facebook. But she told me the reason was because of a friend of ours, a mutual friend on Facebook, had posted something, and one of his family members posted on there, and they got into a big heated debate. And so between the family member and my ex, and this person blocked my ex, so she couldn't see the post anymore, and she wanted to get onto my Facebook to where she could see the post. And I'm thinking, okay. So I gave her my password. I didn't, like I said, I didn't have anything to hide. I wasn't deleting or covering anything at this point. And I remember it was about 2 weeks later, she calls me when I'm working my second job and says, how come you didn't tell me that so-and-so and so-and-so were getting married? She didn't know so-and-so and so-and-so. These were people from my past that she had no idea, you know? And so she was reading my messages, and it was a big old argument about how I don't tell her anything. And I'm thinking, why would I tell you about two people you don't even know? I'd have to tell you the whole story about who they are and how I know them for you to even know who they are. And that began putting red flags in my mind. What's she looking for? And at one point I even asked her, I said, are you looking to see if I'm cheating on you? I mean, what is this all about? Looking at my phone records to find out who I was calling. She got paranoid at the fact that I was, contacting friends and family and talking bad about her. And at the time I wasn't, my friends and family already knew because I had been kind of isolated from them. I wasn't allowed to speak to my friends or family. But I didn't have conversations with them about her at this point. Until one day I was just growing more and more concerned. That her outbursts and her controlling nature and her, she wanted me on the phone every day when I'd come home from work to drive from work to home, which was about 20 minutes. And I would try and engage in conversation. I don't want to talk. And I'm like, okay. So then I wouldn't talk. And she goes, well, if you're just going to be silent, then we're not going to talk. And I'm just like, well, you didn't want me to talk. You know, it was just this type of keeping tabs on me and monitoring everything that I was doing. And she was always going out with her friends, and I wasn't allowed to make friends. I wasn't allowed to go to church because, she called me a hypocrite, said, you want to bring your Bible to work, but you want to act almighty godly, but you're just a big hypocrite. Does everybody really know who you really are? And so I had come to a point in my life, and I'm not proud to say this, but I had come to a point where I had become a liar in my marriage. And I became a liar to protect me. Who'd you talk to today? I didn't talk to anybody, when's the last time you talked to your mom? I had to talk to my mom and my aunt in secret because she'd get mad if I talked to them. And so, I just finally got to the point where I would just be like, nope, didn't talk to anybody today, not talking. And I started deleting my messages because she was watching, and this is the point when I started reaching out to my family and my friends saying, hey, something, I don't know what to do anymore. She's not going to counseling. She's not doing anything. Her anger gets more volatile. And I find out at this point that she'd been communicating at one point with my sister via Facebook. And my sister sent me a bunch of messages about some of their communications. And one of the messages she sent my sister was that she felt like taking the kids to a park and abandoning them because she couldn't handle the kids.
Yeah, I'll ask you if postpartum might have come into play here at all, because I know people who have, had the postpartum and gotten through it and knew who to turn to during that time. But if you have that on top of a psychopath, that isn't getting treated or she's refusing treatment, that can be a dangerous medley of emotion and have quite an impact on you and the kids. Now, how old were the kids when this started to show up?
Well, the kids, our youngest one was kind of a surprise. We weren't planning for him, so he kind of, right after our third one was born is when things really started to get worse. 2 years ago, because it was three kids now. that were all going on. But can I talk about the postpartum for just a minute? Because that brings up something. I had considered that, and I think she had even gone to the doctor, and they had given her some medicine for depression and stuff like that. But during the course of the DHS investigation, a mutual friend of ours that used to be a roommate with us, and my ex got mad and kicked her out of the house, but they had been friends in high school, and she had come forward to me and to DHS saying that she had been this way since she's been in high school, before she ever had any kids. She's been this way. She'd been suicidal. Okay. She'd been bipolar. She admitted to, you know, to being a bipolar in high school that I didn't know about. And so she had told, so this friend came forward and said, no, it's not postpartum. She's a school teacher. This friend is a school teacher. And so she said that she's been this way for, you know, since she was in high school.
Okay. So now we're looking at somebody who has a history with a diagnosis, and now it's really impacting the health of your marriage and your family, and now you're calling this domestic violence. Okay, so many of us that are listening, okay, we have heard this before, been in it before, or understand it, okay? So that some of the information that's been shared already in itself would constitute domestic violence as we know it in the DSM, all right, in the medical journals and how it's coded. Can you give us the extent of the domestic violence, how it impacted the children, and then we're going to move on to, the DHS, and then your divorce and how things completely flipped on you and have turned you into not just a victim of the situation, but a victim of the court.
Sure, sure. And, yeah, I'll just state this out of ignorance. I didn't really identify myself as being in a domestic violence situation. You know, when you think of domestic violence, you typically think of hitting, shoving, pushing, black eyes, and broken bones. And nothing like that really occurred with my relationship. So it was really hard for me to grasp this idea of domestic violence. DHS is the one that really confirmed, and my friends and family all told me as well, it's the cycle of abuse. She would do things, get in my face, slam her hands down, throw things. She would do everything, you know, as close as she could to becoming violent, but without becoming violent with me, at least. And it would be, you know, the control, the not allowing me to communicate with friends and family and things like that. But it was just the arguments that, and I, you know, I listened to one of them here just the other day again, and the screaming and the tear in her, you know, and the emotion in her face, just of,
demeaning. Those audios that you started recording. Right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just want the listeners to understand.
Yeah. No, that's fine. Yeah, I began recording many of the interactions that we had because I knew no one was going to believe me. As a guy, I had a feeling that it would be very difficult for me to be believed without having anything, you know, full-blown proof. And so that's why I began recording. And it was just, you know, I'll give you an example of May of last year on my son's birthday. I had started to get sick, and I don't get sick very often, but I had gotten to the point where I wasn't eating for a week, and I was just, every time I eat, it was this intense pain. And I had gone to the doctor once, and they thought it was a stomach bug, and they couldn't get better. And my son's birthday was coming around, and she was getting mad at me because I was sick, and was telling me that, are you going to act like this on his birthday? And I'm like, I'm sorry. And she didn't want me to go to the hospital. And so finally she said on the Friday before, his birthday was on a Sunday, and on the Friday before she said, just go. So I went, and they thought it might have been my gallbladder, but the gallbladder test came out fine, and they were going to run some more tests, but, you know, still nothing was working. I was still miserable and just in so much pain. And so his birthday comes around, and I didn't help decorate. She was supposed to have a friend that was supposed to help decorate, and they didn't show up. And so she took the fact that her friend didn't show up to out on me and blamed me. And So his birthday comes around, and I was trying to be there as much as I could, but she told me afterwards she refused to take pictures of me with his son because she didn't want her dad to remember him as a lazy, few choice words on his birthday. Yeah. And that really broke my heart. Go ahead.
Now I'm reading. I'm going to read from a DHS report here, okay? It says, Mr. Okay. Arndt, you, okay, has displayed protective capacities in demonstrating care and concern for his children's physical and emotional well-being. After years of verbal
correct.
Abuse and physical intimidation, isolation, and controlling behaviors, Mr. Arndt started surreptitiously recording his wife when he was not at home in order to find out how she was treating the children when he was not at home. The recording revealed, all right, listeners, not an opinion, not a thought, but the recordings revealed. And this is something that I don't think he can't share on here because you can hear the children, minor children, and so that can't be shared here on air. But the recordings revealed Mrs. Arndt losing her temper and shrieking and swearing at the children. He realized that she was not tolerant of the children and needed to remove them from the situation for their safety. Mrs. Arndt does not show protective capacities. She has no insight into her problematic behaviors instead of blaming Mr. Arndt for the family's problems. While he has agreed to any services that may help his family, Mrs. Arndt has declined. And then Ms. Smith, who is the roommate, right?
Correct.
All right. Agrees with Mrs. Arndt, who so she kind of turned on you, and has also been heard by the neighbor yelling profanities at the children. So and now I've gone on, listeners, I have read a plethora of DHS reports, and they are all very consistent, and some are very, very specific, and would bring you to tears. If you were to see this, but it can't be shown because of minor children are on this report, and that would be up to you, David, to redact those or to block them out and share them. But this is what I'm reading, that she's been mean, volatile, controlling, unpredictable, violent, and demeaning to Mr. Arndt, the children. She does not allow Mr. Arndt to have friends, to go to church, or seek medical attention when necessary. She's isolated from friends and family. She has no tolerance for the children's behaviors, as evidenced through interviews with collaterals. So this goes on and on and on and on. So I'm pretty comfortable with who, with the outcome of this particular DHS, and the result was removing you and your children from the situation, correct?
That's correct. But let me just clarify one thing. Mrs. Smith was the current roommate. The roommate that I was referring to earlier was a previous roommate, so it's not the same person that I was referring to, just to clarify.
I apologize.
That's
please
fine.
Do. Thank you so much. Okay. Okay.
You bet.
All right. So now, all right, snapshot, you're out of the house. You and the children are. Had you already filed a protective order against her at that point?
No, once DHS removed me and the children from the home, they encouraged me to go file a protective order. So I met with the local domestic violence shelter or whomever. I'm not sure what they're – I can't remember the name of who they are. But they showed up to help me get a protective order, not only filed against my ex, but also against the roommate, Mrs. Smith. And, of course, the judge denied the protective order. And I think mostly based on the fact that there was no physical violence and the fact that nothing had happened. When the protective orders are very specific, nothing had happened within the last 2 weeks. Well, I'd been removed from the home for a week already, and DHS was involved the other week. So there was kind of a lot of – in that 2 weeks, there wasn't a lot that went on.
Right. So it's one of those typical things. Why did you wait? And so on and so forth. Although this was brought to you and prompted by the DHS. Now, was it revealed in the application for the motion for the protective order that DHS had found that you needed to be removed and whatnot, and the children?
Yes, the DHS, the lady that was there with me did make sure she told the judge that they have substantiated domestic violence against me and the children. She told the judge that.
Okay, so all right, so the judge found it wasn't necessary. However, at this point, you know, the children are separate from their mother, and what was taking place as far as any visitation that was allowed or not?
Well, I was open to the idea of, you know, of the kids seeing the mom. I think the kids needed that. DHS was it was on their time schedule that they wanted to make to ensure, and so I think she only saw that during that month. I think she only saw the kids twice during supervised a DHS worker at the DHS office supervised visitation. I think it was only twice.
Okay. All right. So she was having supervised visits. So that's good. You're open-minded. You weren't trying to alienate the children for their mother, but you were just trying to. Okay. All right. So then they said no to the restraining order. You still have on behalf of the children, what is best and healthy for them in an environment and their concern for the children's health and well-being. Supervised visits. You're no longer living with her. What takes place now?
So I get an apartment and I'm trying to get things in order. I start doing some of their services that they offer to me. And DHS becomes less and less communicative with me in this process. I'm asking questions. I'm trying to figure out what's going on. They seem to be getting irritated at the fact that I'm asking questions. They keep saying that, you know, we'll tell you when we file the case. You know, they write me a letter telling me that I have possession of the children. Let me back up before that. My ex files for divorce shortly thereafter. She files for divorce and an emergency application for custody. So we show up to court. I was able to obtain an attorney through Legal Aid. So he represented me for this initial hearing. And I told DHS that they filed the application for emergency custody. And one of the supervisors at DHS told me, I didn't record it, but I wish I had. She told me, she said, if the judge grants custody to her, we will turn right around and take the kids back out of the home. I'm thinking, well, I didn't know you could do that, but okay, you know. They're telling me that's how concerned they are about the safety of the kids, that they would turn right around and file another judgment or another order with a different judge to come back and do a pickup and bring the kids right back to me. So I kind of was not terribly worried about it, but we show up for court for the court hearing, and DHS shows up to testify, but immediately the judge comes in and says, this is a matter of, you know, my ex-wife versus me and their three children, ages 3, 2, and 1. And she stops when she says that and looks at my ex, doesn't look at me, doesn't have any knowledge of what's going on, hasn't read a DHS report. This is the very first court hearing, looks at her after she read the ages of the kids and said, good God, I would have jumped off a bridge if I was you. Not knowing that my wife has had made many threats of suicide in the past. And right then and there, I knew that it was going to be a very prejudicial and biased against me because of just that statement right then and there. And
okay.
It was like congratulating her for killing herself. I'm sorry?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Flag.
Yeah.
Red flags. Okay.
So, you know, we continued on, and DHS attempted to testify, and my ex's attorney objected to anything she had to say because of hearsay, because the investigation was still going on. So she really was not allowed to say anything. And at one point, when DHS removed me from the home, they told me not to bring our daughter, who was the only one in school at the time, back to school because they didn't want my ex getting her out of school. So I had enrolled her into a different – it was a higher education, you know, she was in pre-K or a Head Start anyway. So it was just a Head Start at a different location, basically. And so the judge reamed me for taking her out of school. And I'm just thinking, I just did what DHS asked me to do. You know, she got onto me for that. And then She wanted to do 50-50 custody, but wanted to order the stipulation that my ex had to be supervised at all times with the children. And I tried to object to that based on the text, and her grandma was going to be the supervisor. And I tried to object based on that a text message that was in the DHS report about when grandma was there at the home and my ex was spanking Kinley, according to the message, 100 times or 1,000,000 times. She said, I spanked her 1,000,000 times. And grandma got mad and tried to stop her, and she said, no, you're the reason she acts this way. Get the F out of my house. And I'm like, grandma, she's doing this in front of grandma too. And the judge looked at me and asked when the date on that was, and I said, well, it was back in March. She goes, it's irrelevant. She goes, if you were so concerned about your wife, this is what the judge said to me, if you were so concerned about this, you shouldn't have gone back. And I'm thinking, what if, is that how you talk to victims, you know?
Now, and do you want to share Canadian county in Oklahoma? And so this is Canadian County District Court. And you want to share who the judge is here?
The judge is Judge Barbara Hatfield.
Barbara Hatfield. Okay, so anybody who's listening in Oklahoma who has had bad experiences in the courtroom with Barbara, Judge Barbara Hatfield, the Honorable Judge Hatfield, okay? This is nothing about, oh, it's a raw deal. It's, you know, oh man, you know, I didn't get everything my way, but it's about true suppression, oppression, and what you feel might truly be abuse and, in that court. I want to hear from you. I want to hear from you. Okay. Please let me know. It's not the first time I've heard about Judge Hatfield before. So we need to know these things because we need to start filling up those judicial complaints with, you know, that show the patterns. And that's when they should start being taken seriously. And if the Judicial Accountability Committee does not take well-documented abuse by of power seriously, then we have more things that we can come after them with. This is all about paper trails, people. Chime in, share your stories. You can get in touch with me on Injustice in Oklahoma Exposed Facebook. Message me. Let me know. You can also email me at injusticeinoklahoma@gmail.com. Please, we need you to chime in. We need you to share your stories. If you know anybody else who has that information or who's gone through something in that court, we would like to hear about it, okay? All right, so go forward. Thank you very much for letting me interrupt.
No problem, no problem. So at the court, they ordered her to be supervised, you know, and grandma was going to be her supervisor. During this process, I found out that she was violating that order. She was taking the kids to and from. She had gotten a job at a daycare, and she hadn't worked at all before, but she finally got a job at a daycare, which she lasted a month and a half before she was terminated. But so she was taking the kids back and forth to work by herself without being supervised by grandma. And she had, at one time she'd taken the kid, our son, to Walmart. So she was doing these, and then she started selling. Well, she showed up on Halloween with a new car, and she had sold a car that had her name on it. Well, when a divorce is filed, there's a temporary injunction that is automatically filed. You cannot sell marital property. Well, granted, she had everything. I didn't have anything. My apartment was furnished. I had to start over. She wouldn't give me anything. So she had all the furniture, and I had the car that I was driving, but she had a car that had her name on it, and she sold that, and her grandma bought her a brand-new car. Her grandma bought her a house paid for, so she lives rent-free in a house that's paid for and a car that's paid for. Doesn't pay any bills, still doesn't work. So I told my legal aid attorney, and he told me, well, he goes, yeah, that's probably not very good, but I'm going to quit on you because I found another job. And so I asked him, I said, are you going to appoint me another attorney? And he said, no, we don't have anybody else to appoint you. So now
okay.
Legal Aid puts
right.
on me.
So
go ahead.
You had sought services and representation through Legal Aid. That attorney's
correct.
Name is?
Danny Joseph.
Is, pardon me?
Danny Joseph.
Danny
Joseph.
Okay. All right. So he quit on you. He said they weren't able. Of course, Legal Aid is not obligated to assist you, but he just kind of quit on you, so you're left out there in the middle of nowhere, right?
Correct, but he quit on me in the middle of stuff that I had informed him. So technically, by statute, if there's things that are going on, they really are not supposed to leave you. Because I had informed him that she was violating a temporary injunction and that she was, violating the judge's order to not be supervised. But he disregarded that and said, well, I'm quitting. You're going to have to find someone else to file that. So
gotcha. Right.
That's
an area where there's a gray area and judges and to me, it's not gray. I get it. Leaving somebody high and dry. But it's up to the judge's discretion and how they interpret the need. Am I right or what do you know? This is not Jeremy, is it?
No, this is not Jeremy German.
Okay. Right.
Jeremy
okay.
German
this
comes
is,
in late.
Right, exactly. So this is the beginning of this, tumbleweed. It starts to roll into another and another and another, or snowball. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. So then you're left without representation, and they're claiming that they don't have to represent you when they probably really do need to be representing you or find
correct.
A replacement. Okay.
Correct. And so I'm now panicking because I don't know anything about this, and I – made all these allegations, these turning in my wife to DHS because, trying to protect my kids, and now I'm left high and dry. So that concerns me, and so I report to DHS to my caseworker that what had happened with my ex violating the order, and that my attorney had quit on me, and she kind of scolded me for not telling her sooner, and I'm like, well, I don't know what you want me to do. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I don't have an attorney now. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said she was going to tell the district attorney, which apparently she never did. Shortly thereafter, and this is in November, and she's in my house with the parental aide that's coming in to do the parental aide classes that I said I would do. And they ask what the status of it is, and she goes, well, hopefully by the end of the month, this is what she told me. She said, hopefully by the end of the month, the kids will be in your care. That's what they're hoping for. And so I started to cry. I'm thinking, okay, great. And this was the beginning of November. And I didn't hear anything. And toward the end of November, I get a call from another caseworker that is telling me that she's going to be my new caseworker, that my old caseworker is going to be moving on. It's being transferred to her. She does a different portion of this. And I said, well, can you update me what's going on? She goes, well, I can't really give you any information right now because it's with the DA's office. We're just waiting to get information. And I'm like, okay. And then I get an email from another DHS worker who wants to do a home visit. They're supposed to do monthly home visits. Now, keep this in mind. DHS is supposed to do a monthly home visit every month, but they only did home visits with me. They never did a single home visit with my ex-wife. I asked DHS, why are you doing home visits only with me and not with her? And this is what their answer, because you will let us into your home and you're more cooperative. If we tried to do it with her, she would give us a harder time and we don't want to deal with that. I'm thinking, well, that ought to be a clue, but you're only wanting to do home visits with me. And I'm the parent that you say is protecting the kids, but you're not checking the home of the person that you're saying is not protecting the kids. They never once did
a
home visit during this.
Switch. This is a complete turnaround from how this started out. Then they put another DHS worker in there, and all of a sudden, you know, it's kind of like you're being treated like you're the one who is the parent with the risk. And it's because the other parent who you and your children were removed for the health and well-being of those children, then now you're being treated as though you were the ones that were putting the children at risk. So this is a total turnaround here. So you're feeling
Okay.
Yeah. So I get this other DHS worker that emails me, says she wants to come do a home visit, and I'm like, who are you? And she goes, well, your caseworker can't make it, so she asked me to come. So she comes and checks my house out, and I said, can you tell me the status of what's going on? She goes, well, this is a supervised case, so I don't really have a lot of details. I said, a supervised case? What are you talking about? I thought this was a deprived case. DHS was originally investigating a deprived case, and now they were now turning it into a supervised. And I said, what does that mean? And she goes, well, you'll have to talk to your caseworker. Well, so I finally find out that a supervised case means that what they're going to do is they're just going to watch both of us, and if we both behave, they're going to disappear. And I'm thinking, what? So now I have no attorney. DHS is telling me that we're not going to go after for deprived. We're going to just monitor to make sure she's behaving herself, and then we're going to disappear. And my ex, in the meantime, is texting me over and over again, if you don't want to work things out by the end of the 90-day wait period that you have to wait for a divorce, I'm going to go ahead and sign the papers. And I'm panicking because now I'm left with – everybody seems to be losing interest. And I'll say this. My entire time in law enforcement, I never understood why victims – never understood completely why victims went back to their abuser until this point in my life. I'm sitting here thinking, DHS took me out of this house. They're supposed to be helping me. My attorney quits on me. I'm left. I have nobody. They're not even talking to me. The district attorney has never once communicated with me. And I began to panic. And I'm thinking, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, the only way that I can protect my children is for me to make things up with my wife, because DHS is saying this is going to be supervised. And so as long as she behaves herself, they're going to go away. Then what? Now I'm going to go to court in a divorce with no attorney that I can't afford, and I'm going to lose my kids.
Oh, God.
And so
I'm sorry.
I make a decision to try and work things out with my ex, because I'm thinking I can protect my kids better if I'm in the home. I'll endure the abuse. I'll just endure it. I can protect myself better if I'm in the home.
You're in the front line there to protect the situation because there was no place else to go.
Yep. And I thought, you know, I'm going to be with my new job. I'll be working nights, so I'll be home most of the day, and the kids will only be with mom when I'm at night mostly. And I thought, you know, I'll just suck it up. And DHS doesn't know that we're talking about working things out. And then guess what? They file a petition on me. They file charges on me for failure to protect my children. And that set me off when they filed a petition that called me a deadbeat dad. And you read the DHS report, Tanya. There's nowhere in there that they even indicated that I was abusive or had any unprotective tendencies. But they're saying now we're going to file charges on you because you failed to protect your kids when I'm the one that turned her in.
Okay.
And so now I'm back.
So because listeners here believe you, they believe you, okay? I know they believe you, but I am to encourage you to black out the children's names and even your wife's name, okay? Because you don't need it, okay? What we need for support here right now is you, okay? Mm-hmm. They need your case number, all right? They need to see these reports from DHS. So all of a sudden, you have no choice but to throw yourself into a fire, okay, to put out the fire to protect your children, and you will take the abuse. You'll take the burns. You will, you will endure the pain because you are there to make sure that your kids don't have to. All right, so I'm going to encourage you to redact that information as far as the names and anything that might seem to be retaliatory, because actually what you're looking for is support for you, okay, and your children. All right, so I'm going to encourage you to post those, to share them in the comment section of PPJG.me. Okay, that's Marty Oakley's website. And listeners, you can find that as well a little bit later on once they're up, if he chooses to do this, just by pressing the promo to the link where you can hear the archive of this and as well, you know, see the promo, and you go down, you open this up, and you're going to see a comment section, and this information or the link to it will be provided, yes or no?
David. Yes, I'll provide it. Yes, I'll provide it.
Okay, thank you very much. I want the case number to that. People, you know, a couple letters out there, and we'll get into that a little bit later. It would not hurt. We need support. We need support for people like David that are willing to come forward and say, and not be too proud, not be, you know, oh my gosh, you know, I can't say anything because I'm a guy and I've been abused or whatever. No, you're standing up for the health and well-being of your children, and you're standing up for yourself, for crying out loud. And I know that you wish that your ex-wife would be okay. I know you don't wish ill will on her. I know that. We've talked, okay? Yeah. You know, I know you don't wish that, but right now what is most important is to protect yourself, because you need that oxygen mask for you and your children. So thank you, listeners, okay? Just keep that in mind as we roll through this podcast, and you will get more information.
Thank you.
So where were we, David?
So DHS files a petition against me for failure to protect my children. And that devastates me, because I'm thinking DHS is telling me, patting me on the back, saying, good job for turning her in. You did a good job. You're doing the right thing. And now they're turning around and slapping me in the face. So we go to court. We have a court hearing, and I go with my ex. At this point, DHS knows that we're working things out, or trying to work things out, and I have to save face, because I provided DHS a lot of information, and my ex is mad at me for turning her in, and she's looking at me, telling me that I need to tell them I'm lying, and
conundrum. What a conundrum. I mean, you know, this is what people have to do, you know?
Yeah.
I think we are with you on this. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I go to court, and I tell them I don't have an attorney. I can't afford an attorney. And because a deprived petition was filed against me, I should have had an opportunity to be appointed an attorney. But they ignored the fact of my cries for no attorney. And at this point, again, I'm thinking DHS is turning against me because they're filing charges on me. So I don't even remember everything I said, Tanya. To be honest, I don't remember everything I said because I was mad. I know that I made a fool of myself in court a little bit. I should say I've embarrassed myself in court a little bit because one of the things I said was that my ex is not a villain, and I don't believe she's a villain. I just said everybody's trying to villainize her. I'm trying to downplay some things, but not say that I lied, because I didn't lie. I didn't lie about anything, Tanya. I told the truth. But now I'm trying to save face, because I'm thinking now I'm going to have to live with her because no one's helping me. And how do I save face without saying that I lied? And so I say all these things, and go ahead.
Helping the kids.
Right. And again, the evidence is there that the kids have been abused or neglected and all that kind of stuff. It's not my testimony doesn't change that. And
correct.
So DHS told me that day was a turning point where they said I was no longer credible. And they couldn't trust anything I said anymore. They couldn't put me on the stand because they said that I basically said all that because I felt unappreciative and that I was saying that to villainize her. And I said, well, I don't think I said it that way. But I said, to be honest, I don't know what I said, because I was mad at you guys because you're turning on me now. You're supposed to help me. I have an hour, 2 hour long, and I need to send that to you as well, Tanya, of DHS sitting in my living room, and I'm explaining to them why I did what I did. This is why. And they're like, okay, well, yeah, we get it, but we don't care.
Audio recording.
I have
correct?
An actual recording. I do.
Okay. Okay.
Of me telling DHS why I said that in court.
Okay.
And but they didn't care. They decided they were going to drop charges, and I'm thinking. And so there's guilt. Now I have guilt, thinking, am I the one that caused this? Am I the one that caused DHS to drop charges and not protect my kids? And but I'm at this point. Well, let me back up. They dropped charges later on down the road. I'm still trying to work things out, and she is still in denial, and we're still having fights in the home. She's saying that she can't believe that I would turn her in like that, and that I've lied about all of this, and that all this stuff, and says it's all my fault, and the reason she smokes is because of me and her grandma, and all this kind of stuff. So she was blaming me, and I was like, I can't do this. And so when our tax money came in, I hired an attorney through an Oklahoma attorney resources by the name of Jeremy Jarman to represent me for the second DHS hearing. I didn't have an attorney for this one where I made a fool of myself, but I hire him for the second one, and I hire him for the divorce. And of course, Jeremy tells me that the DA says I made some pretty damning statements in the court, but he didn't tell me exactly what he said. But he said, I'm going to try and fight for you. You know, you're the victim here. Told me all the things, I'm going to put you on the stand and we're going to get this. And I said, what about the judge reading the DHS report? Now, at this point, I thought the judge would have read the DHS report, but he tells me the judge doesn't read the DHS report. It has to be filed in a motion. And I can't remember the name of the motion, but you have to bring a motion before the judge to bring that document for the judge to read it. And I said, oh, okay. And of course, my ex's attorney's not going to bring this document before the judge. He's not going to file that. So he told me he was going to do that. Turns out he didn't. And in this last court hearing that we had, he actually admitted in court that he never did it. He never filed this motion for the judge to read this. So the judge never read this DHS report. And the judge never heard any evidence. So, but go ahead.
Okay. I want to just take a 2 minute break for you. Okay. I just want to take a 2 minute break for you. Okay. This is extremely emotional. Okay. So we're going to slow it down just a little bit. You are doing amazing. You're doing amazing. We're all proud of you and we're all standing by you. Okay. I'm going to just take a 2 minute break so you can just start to breathe a little bit. Not because I hear that you need to. But actually, it's a good time too, because just as we pivot to the next portion of what's gone on, and I just want to share a few things with our listeners, okay? So stay on, listen on, but just know that you are doing amazing, okay? You're doing great, and we are engaged, and we're here with you and for you. Okay, so listeners, this is about TS Radio Network right now, and as Stephen Burke from 89.9 has been loyally live streaming our shows and is able to do this 3 weeks out of the month. The third week he's not able to. It's out of Stuart, Oklahoma, 89.89 again, WKLRB. Marty's show, Marty Oakley, TS Radio Network, is expanding. It has it's growing. We're becoming something that is appealing to many, many people here. And I just want to share with you, some of their lineup and ask you to please visit ppjg.me so that you can see what is in the venue, what you might have missed and you might want to just click on and listen to. And it costs nothing, as our listeners know, through the live stream, to to join in and get the friendly reminders of the shows that you want to hear about, so you can decide whether this is something that you are interested in or not, or somebody that you know may be interested in or not. We don't come after you and send you all kinds of these things, okay? We're not like that. This is in appreciation for you, for your caring, for your listenership. But hey, we've got a brand new show and coming on. And that's with Arlene Mullen and Jeff Park, okay? And that's about dialysis advocates. There are some very, very compelling stories that I've seen before they have even been on, just through some of the stories that Arlene has shared with me. And of course, you know, with Marty Oakley, the network owner and producer. Okay, so you will, if that interests you, you're going to want to hear about it, okay? You're going to want to listen to Marty Oakley's show and Carly Suzanne Waldron on guardianship abuse, okay? Huge. I've watched people listening to these shows for the first time and their jaws drop. It doesn't happen everywhere, but it happens far too often. You're going to want to listen in. Are you an animal lover? Do you love animals? You don't have to be an animal lover to advocate against the abuse on animals. So you might want to be interested in listening in to Voices Carry. The animals, there's a show on that. Okay, there's a whistleblower show once a week, sometimes twice a week. Okay, so this is an amazing array of shows of a varied interest. And, oh, yeah, let's not forget me, TNT Tiny Talks, where your voice is heard and your story is told. And I tend to focus on municipal, state, government corruption. Judges, lawyers, victims of the court, and how to solve the big problem, okay? I don't believe that there should be a bar association. It's a private entity that has developed their own rules, and they back each other's butts more often than not, a breeding ground for corruption, whether it was planned that way or not. The same as judicial accountability committees. All right, it's really hard. It's really tough for an attorney or another judge to sit back and say, hey, judge, you're doing the wrong thing. That's far too often the exception to the rule itself. Okay? So we need you to be aware of these shows that are far beyond the one you're listening to right now, although this is just as valuable as the others. I want you to understand the value of this network, which Marty Oakley is a pioneer, and she is a groundbreaker for this kind of advocacy work, and has a permanent appearance and panel at the Whistleblowers Summit every year in Washington, D.C. right now. Okay, so this is a great resource for you once you start listening to these shows, getting to know who these people are, becoming friends with them on social media. You're going to learn a lot. Okay. How you doing, David?
Better.
Okay.
So, David, you're a victim currently of some municipal situations where things have been turned on you, and the judge is now finding that you are the one that's breaking the law? Let's talk about that.
Okay, so fast forwarding to the divorce, the judge decided, the same judge, by the way, was over the DHS hearing and the divorce. They, for whatever reason, they decided to make the same judge. A little biased in my opinion, but we have a hearing. I used my tax money to pay for my attorney. And I told the attorney, I said, look, I'm using the tax money. It's the only way I have to do this. But I said, if I can't use this, I have nothing to pay you with. And he was aware that I'm using the tax money on that. And he said, that'll all be decided in the end. She sold meritable property. We're going to fight for that in the end. That's fine. Write me a check. So I wrote him a check for the, you know, using the tax money to be able to, for his services. And the other party files for a motion to get the tax money because they want the tax money back. And so in this hearing to redistribute the tax returns and to determine child support, arrearages, granted a divorce hasn't been decided at this point, but because we've been separated a year, they think I owe back child support. And so the judge decides
Was that opposed in the temporary order?
Not to my knowledge, it was not.
Okay, it would say so in the temporary order. Okay, so now they're kind of like deciding to plug this stuff in.
Right, right. And so that was what was on the hearing, so that's what I came to court prepared for. In a previous hearing, by the way, a guardian ad litem was appointed, and I won't get into too many details about that, but the judge ordered that I would pay all of the guardian ad litem. My ex didn't have to pay a dime of that. I had to pay it because I held the tax money. So I was having to pay $1,500 for the guardian ad litem. So in this hearing about the taxes, the judge decides that basically my attorney comes back in and tells me that the judge decided that everything was a gift to my ex because grandma had bought the car. Even though the car was titled in both of our names, and some of the money was from a previous sale. There was a lot of information I provided saying that grandma may have bought the car, but there's a lot of money from me that's tied up into that car, you know? And
exactly.
They said, well, you know, and then the furniture, well, we're going to give you a $750 credit for the furniture or, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And so we are finding that, you're going to owe her $4,450. And I'm like, I don't agree. That's just, yeah. So I said, okay, whatever. Fine. I'll appeal that. Just whatever. You're ordering me to pay. The judge is ordering me to pay $44. Now, let me back up. I was in the marriage part of this. The first hearing was the only hearing I was ever in the courtroom. The rest of this stuff, I was not allowed in the courtroom. I was sitting outside and the attorneys met in the judge, but in closed doors. I don't know what was said in these hearings. I've asked for narrative statements, and the judge is declining those.
Okay, so now,
I don't know what was said.
Okay, so there's a question mark about ex parte. There's a question mark about some ex parte hearings here. Now, I kind of want to move this along because time is going to fly really fast. We have got, you know, not that much time left, and it looks like we're going to have a part two. At least a part of a part two to continue telling your story. But I want the listeners to hear just how some of the things have gone for you when you have asked for assistance by the court, not for legal advice, but just some assistance. Now, there's something to do with you requesting that fees be waived when it comes to an appeal. So you are talking to
a district court who makes it
quite clear that she's been there for over a couple of decades and she knows these things. Now, that appeal that you were interested in having the fees waived, which means there's a pauper's affidavit that is filed because here you are responsible for paying for everything else depleted, potentially able to be approved. And you would know that better than me because there are guidelines to be followed, which is also at the discretion of the judge. But apparently this clerk decided to make it her discretion. But I need one point of clarification here. Was that appeal for the district court or for the higher court?
The appeal is for the district court. I filed the appeal, and the Supreme Court allowed me to file a pauper's affidavit for their fees. The district court refused They said they don't do Popper's affidavits because it's an existing case, not a new case.
Well, I think that is a bunch of bull crap, but I'm going to have to just look into that just a little bit, because somebody can become in need of having fees waived in the middle of a case. But Marty, are you there? Can you have that cue that you can play that? Thank you, Marty.
Yes.
Okay.
This is Marie Hirsch. She's the court clerk.
All right.
We do not give out Popper's affidavits. This is not a new case. You cannot get a Popper's affidavit to file an appeal.
Yes, thank you.
To file an appeal in an existing case.
But according to the statute, it doesn't say that.
You're taking part of the statute out of context.
Okay, well, I guess what I'm asking,
if you're practicing as your own attorney, then you can argue that fact all you want. But the fact of the matter is we do not give Popper's affidavits out to file an appeal.
Okay, but what I'm asking for is what rule or where are we referring that it says that it can't be added to a new, so that I know, because from what I can see.
I've been here 23 years.
Okay.
I've done this for 23 years.
I'm not saying you don't. I don't.
I'm saying we will not give you a Popper's affidavit for an appeal case.
Yes.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So
she later threatened to have me removed from the. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead. You narrate what just happened, and then I'll add something to it.
Okay. Yeah, during that, it was about a 10-minute conversation, and we went back and forth. You heard my tone. I never raised my voice. That was kind of that way throughout. Toward the end of it, she says, if you'd like, I can have deputies remove you from here. And I'm like, I'll leave. Why are we wanting to have me removed by deputies? I'm just asking for clarification. And that was, it's about a 10-minute recording.
Okay, right. So, listeners, the reason why I asked him to just give me a clip of that recording is for the interest of time. It goes by so fast. However, that recording, if it's not in the comments already of ppjg.me, it will be, okay? As well as where I have posted this on Journeys to Justice Facebook page and Injustice in Oklahoma Exposed Facebook page. There's two of them. Oh, by the way, quick comment. My original Injustice in Oklahoma Exposed page, since it was hacked, has actually shown up. It's actually shown back up. Now, I don't have access to that yet. I try to log in. I can't. I'm going to find a way to do that, because we have a few thousand followers. I think it's gone down a little bit, but not much since then. So I'll integrate the two once I get this figured out, which will be soon. So we'll have that back up and running in a more effective way, and continuing with Journeys to Justice. So I just want to let you guys know that. So there's two of them, Injustice in Oklahoma Exposed in uppercase. That was my original one on Facebook. And then there's Injustice in Oklahoma without the uppercase that I opened up about a month after it was hacked, just to let people know that I'm still here and not gone. But I will keep you all posted on that. So, again, the purpose for that interjection is you will be able to see and hear exactly what we're talking about here, the longer and the fuller versions. All right, Marty, do you have another short clip that you can share with us that you were able to upload?
No, I can't do that while we're on air. So,
okay, that's fine.
Okay.
All right, so thank you, Marty, so much. So, David, can you please share what those other clips are about? When people are going to click on them, because I know what I heard when I listened to the complete conversation with you and your attorney, Jeremy.
Garman?
What's his name, please?
Jeremy Jarman.
Jeremy Jarman, and where is he out of, please?
Oklahoma City.
He's out of Oklahoma City. We'd love to hear from you, listeners, anybody who has good or bad experiences with Jeremy Jarman. You all know our contact information already. So Jeremy Jarman drops the ball like so many other attorneys that suborn and are part of the collusion situation, okay? He drops the ball on this man and his family. He drops the ball. He essentially threatened David Arnett if he exposed what he did. Do you want to just give the listeners a little bit of that narrative that they will be able to listen to and will follow up on?
Sure, absolutely. So at the last hearing that we had this last Wednesday, I had filed some motions against him for some improper practice, some stuff that he did. One of the things I was alleging was that I was found guilty of contempt, but I was found guilty of contempt based on the fact that they added some stuff to court-ordered minutes after I left. It was not in my presence. I did not sign an acknowledgement. I had no idea. And so but right before I went to testify about that, he told me that I was lying in that motion, that he had already talked to the judge and he had talked to the bailiff and he had talked to my ex-wife's attorney, and they all know that I was there outside the courtroom hanging around after it, and he knows that I signed that. But yet he testified to the fact that I got so mad that I left immediately. So he contradicted himself on stand as to what he said in the recording, and basically told me that he threatened me in this recording that if I go in there, he calls it a duty of candor is what he says. I have a duty of candor because you're about to commit perjury is what he's telling me. And I have a duty of candor to stop you from doing so. And I'm not committing perjury is what I told him. But he said that if you do this, it's not going to be good for you. We'll flush you down the river.
That to me. Yeah. They give these excuses to withdraw. And they try to make you out to be the bad person. They create the narrative, you know, that you're the bad person so that they can get out, so that they're not basically up against the judge that has already made a decision on your matter.
Correct.
Okay.
So he basically tells me he had ex parte communication with Judge Hatfield about my case, and the Judge Hatfield knows that I was there after the court proceeding as well, which is very concerning. If that allegation is true of what he says, that he had that communication, that's obviously concerning to me that he would have that ex parte communication with the judge.
Yep.
But like I said, he threatened that if I –
communications are not allowed under normal circumstances, and this is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Correct.
Go ahead.
No, you're fine. You're fine. And so the basically he threatened that he would flush me down the river or flush this down the river if I went in there and testified to that. And I told the attorney that was representing me for the contempt that he had threatened me, and he didn't bring it up before the judge at all. And so I was, of course, found guilty of contempt of court for not following an order. And later, in which the judge says in there, and I'm going to get the minutes transcribed, but the judge says, well, I made this order based on the knowledge that I was told that you had your tax money, which apparently my attorney told the judge I still have all my tax money. And so that's why she made the ruling. So she's saying I made this ruling based on that idea, but now I'm finding out that that's different, and that's concerning to me, but I'm still finding you guilty because you didn't follow my order. Well, you were given wrong information. How can you find me guilty of contempt when you don't have all the facts?
Right, the attorney should have redacted and or corrected the information, but of course, at this point, you understand that he's not on your side.
Right. Exactly. So that's where kind of we're at today, and I know there's a lot of details that we've left off, and you know, maybe we'll cover that in a part two, like you said, where we can kind of fill in some of the gaps, especially as I'm able to get some of these recordings downloaded for people to be able to, DHS report for people to be able to look at. But you know, it's bottom line, and I'm going to say this, Tanya, if I had to close with a statement, if you were to ask me, if I were to go back, would I do anything different? And I want you to weigh the gravity of this statement I'm about to say. I would. I would have never, never turned her in if I knew from right now. I'm hoping that in the future I can say, yes, I did the right thing. But right now, if you would ask me today, would you have done anything different? I would have never called in. I would have endured the abuse. And the gravity of that statement means that I would not be talking with my family and my friends. I would not be going to church. I would not be doing a lot of things that I'm doing now. But I'm fearful of my kids' safety. And so if I knew that I was going to be victimized,
well,
and I feel
more. Because the system
more...
that's supposed to be wrong or right refused to stand by you. And that's why
mm-hmm.
you're saying that. Because had you known the a bad situation was taking place to the point that DHS had you and yourself removed from that bad situation to protect the kids, and they're not standing by you now. Instead, they're calling you an abusive parent because you subjected them, but the judge kind of forced you. Are you freaking kidding me? So I hear guilt in your voice, even though I know you know better. Okay, I know you know better. All right, so it's sure, what a shame. What a shame to be put in that position where that you would have to, you know, go back and not protect your kids, knowing that the court wouldn't protect your kids.
But are my kids any better now? Are my kids protected now?
They're
not.
We're protecting them.
They're protected every other week.
And okay, so where do you stand right now with visitation with the kids? And are the kids with? Okay, let's. All right, I'm going to give you. All right, where do you stand right now with where the kids are at? Who are they spending time with?
We have 50-50 custody, so we get the exchanges every Friday. So they're with me. For a week, and then they're with my ex for a week, and grandma lives at the house with my ex, though she has help. I'm doing it on my own. I have no help, but she has the help from grandma to help raise these kids. I'm doing it every other week completely by myself.
But you're used to that. You're used to that. You were
you're
doing
right.
that when you've been under an abusive roof, okay?
You're correct. I was. I was doing it. I just had a babysitter during the day, you know?
Right. Right. Are you concerned for your children's health and well-being emotionally and physically right now?
I am, because on our anniversary here a couple of months ago, my ex sent me a text message saying that, you know, I'm responsible for everything still, which means she's still in denial, which means that she's not getting the help that she needs to be able to address the problems that she has, which makes me – it's not that I – and I've told everybody all along, it's not that I want to take the kids from the mom. I don't want that. That's not what's best for the kids. But mom needs the help that she needs in order to be the mom for these kids that they need. So I am concerned because I don't see any major changes in her that would lead me to believe, or any apologies or any acceptance of anything. It's all still my fault. And I'm not saying that I'm a perfect husband or a father. I know I made my fair share of mistakes. But – I didn't deserve what happened to me to happen by any means.
No, you didn't. Okay, so listeners, I'm going to have to stop. You know, we're going to have to call this podcast as far as interview and sharing David Arndt's story. You know, we're going to have to end it here for right now. There's going to be more. You've heard the resources in order to follow up with, and I'm going to encourage you to please, please look at ppjg.me, because information will be shared there. The archive will be shared there. Share this podcast. Men and women are abused, and the system and corruption has no party lines. Let's stay united. We're going to bring David back on next Sunday. You will have the ability to see this information in advance because there's more to share before we put a close to this story. The story won't be closed until justice is met. David is a minister who has brought so much to other people and helping other people. So, that being said, thank you very much, David, for sharing a great part of your story, for wanting to protect your children like so many of us have done. Thank you, Marty Oakley from TS Radio Network, and I'm Tanya Hathaway with TNT. Tanya Talks, where your voice is heard and your story is told. And Stephen Burke, you rock, from KLRB 89.9, Stuart, Oklahoma. Good night, everybody, and thank you for tuning in. We'd love your comments.